This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. With a growing number of COVID-19 cases in the state, many are on edge. We'll go to Fremont County, where one woman is dealing with her mother's hospitalization.
I am her emergency contact, and nobody contacted me, and that is a problem.
Experts give tips on how to stay mentally healthy during the coronavirus pandemic.
Isolation is a funny thing because as human beings, we crave to be social and emotionally connected to other human beings.
And we'll hear from a couple of University of Wyoming students from China who were in their country when the original outbreak occurred. It's impacted their parents.
There are no any money from the business. That's a problem.
Join us for those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. It's been a busy week for confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the state, with many wondering why the testing has been limited. The issue is limited numbers of test kits. State Department of Health spokeswoman Kim Detai says medical providers are deciding which patients to test and prioritizing those at highest risk.
Folks connected with long-term care facilities. That's probably one of the strongest examples. People who are hospitalized with unexplained illness and symptoms consistent. Those kind of things.
But one COVID-19 patient in Lander, who's one of nine residents and staff at Showboat Retirement Center who tested positive, was initially passed over for a test at Sage West Hospital. That's according to her daughter, Tesla Meyer. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr spoke with her. Meyer says her mother rode a senior center bus to St. John's Medical Clinic in Lander last Friday to get treated for a severe cough.
I told her that, well, they'll probably send you to the hospital and probably put you in quarantine. And she was kind of shocked. She's not really like up to date on what's going on. So she went to her appointment and then she called me later telling me, yeah, they sent me to the hospital. Calls me less than an hour later saying that she's done and she's ready to come home. So I go and pick her up and she's got a mask on. It's like kind of dangling off her face because she has her oxygen on too. So I get her in the car, get her walker in the car and ask her, did they give you any tests? And she's like, well, no, they said I have an infection in my lungs or in my chest and they gave me antibiotics. And so I take her back to the showboat, and then later that evening, we found out, you know, that there was a person in Fremont County with a confirmed case of the coronavirus.
So when you got that news, what was going through your mind?
Since they sent her home from the hospital without testing her, I wasn't worried of her having the coronavirus, really, because I trusted them to test her if they needed to, which the next morning, my friend texted me and said, hey, not trying to be an alarmist or anything, but I did hear that the first case was a resident at the showboat. And so I called the ER first just to make sure. And I talked to an ER nurse and she said, no, we didn't test her. She didn't have a fever and she didn't have pneumonia. She seemed to be doing okay. So we're saving the tests for people who are really sick.
How long was it between when you learned from a friend that it was somebody at Showboat? How long after that did you actually hear from the retirement center?
Well, I contacted them and they confirmed that it was a resident at the Showboat who was the first case in Fremont County and that they were on lockdown and the Wyoming Department of Health was on their way. And I understand they were dealing with something that they've never had to deal with before. And I'm not blaming the Showboat. I'm blaming more like, I feel like the Wyoming Department of Health could have done more to keep in contact with me.
So then the State Department of Health came in and started doing interviews. Do you know when they tested your mom?
Yeah, they tested her on Saturday, I think afternoon. They said the test results should be back Monday. I guess Monday night when I found out that there were seven more confirmed cases. through County 10 and not by anybody calling me. I mean, they didn't, of course, say any names or anything, but of course, my first assumption was, oh, yeah, well, my mom has it then. I still called the showboat. I called, and it was just busy. And I called a bunch of times, and it just was busy every time. So I was trying to call everybody I could. I called the Wyoming Department of Health. They told me to call 211. I didn't get any information there. I called the ER to see if my mom had been admitted, and she hadn't. So I didn't know what else to do, so I just did what I could and went to bed that night. And the next morning, finally got through about 9:30, where someone answered, and I was like, so my mom infected, does she have the virus? And she's like, yes, she does. And so they told me that she was resting and drinking fluids and she was doing fine. I called later and asked if they would go check on her. And the nurse checked her oxygen level and it was really low. And so I was like, if it was your mom, would you call the ambulance? She's like, yes. And I was like, okay, I'm doing it. At this point, still nobody had contacted me to confirm and say, hey, like, your mom has the virus.
Mm.
The only person that told me this was a nurse at the showboat who, I think she's just a fill-in. She normally preps their meals.
And so now your mom is in the ICU. How is she doing?
She says she's feeling a little bit better than she was yesterday, but not much.
Mm-hmm. And it must be really difficult not to be able to visit her at all.
Right. I know it's the safest thing to do is to keep away from there, but I don't know if I'm sick or my partner. We both have slight symptoms, but we're still at our house on lockdown right now and quarantined. So yesterday, actually, we emailed the Wyoming Department of Health. They're like, sorry, we didn't get a hold of you, because I did voice my concerns, saying, like, I don't understand why nobody has called me. Like, my mom has the coronavirus, and I had to jump through hoops to find that out. And so, I mean, when I asked her about the testing, she said I could go get tested if I wanted to, but that it wasn't necessary, which, cool, if I don't have to leave my house, it's fine, but I don't know. It's the testing situation is really messed up.
So what needs to change? If you could say something to public officials in Wyoming that are handling this pandemic, what would you say to them?
First of all, I think that we need to get more testing. I mean, I'm sure there are a lot more people out there that are infected and walking around and spreading the disease and don't even know it. And I mean, it's really ridiculous that it took so much for me to get that information that I needed to know to make sure that my mom was okay. Like, I am her emergency contact and nobody contacted me. And that is a problem.
Well, Tesla, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with me. And I hope that your mom recovers soon.
Thanks, Savannah.
Now let's bring in Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr, who's reporting from Lander. Hi, Savannah.
Hi, Bob. Good to talk to you.
That's an alarming story from Tesla Meyer.
Yeah, it is on many levels, but what raises the most serious questions for me is the fact that this woman was initially passed over for testing. She's 63 years old with pre-existing respiratory problems. She's a resident at a long-term care facility. She had a severe cough at the time. I've reached out to Sage West, and they say they can't comment on this specific instance to protect the patient's privacy. But based on what we know from the State Department of Health, she probably should have fallen squarely into their criteria for testing. She also rode the senior center bus twice on Friday and visited St. John's Clinic and Sage West in Lander. It seems likely that she could have infected other vulnerable people.
And I assume we can expect the number of cases in Fremont County to continue to rise.
We can. I spoke with Lander's assistant mayor, Regine Struby-Fossen, and as of Friday morning, she said a shipment of medical supplies was on its way to Fremont County.
Test kits and PPE, which is personal protective equipment, have been routed to our Fremont County Incident Command Center. And we have hundreds of test available to us at Fremont County.
She said the number of people hospitalized for the illness at Sage West in Lander also rose from 3 to 4 by Friday morning, though she said no one is in critical condition or on a ventilator. She wasn't sure how many tests had been administered in Fremont County.
So how are cities and towns in Fremont County responding to all this?
Well, like everywhere else in Wyoming, the schools are all closed here. After the governor's order on Thursday night, bars and restaurants are only providing curbside pickup and delivery. The city of Lander declared a state of emergency earlier this week, which frees up city officials to respond with policy change to the situation without going through the city council. Lander and Riverton City buildings are all closed to the public. Residents are being asked not to gather in groups of more than 10, and law enforcement throughout Fremont County have suspended non-urgent service. That means we're all being asked not to call in, for example, about a dog at large or other things like that.
What's the mood like in Lander?
Well, I am practicing social distancing. I actually haven't left my apartment in several days except to take the dog out. But my partner ventured out on Thursday for groceries. That was before the governor's order, so he said some bars and restaurants had a few customers. The locally owned grocery store was busier than usual, probably because word got around that they had a shipment of toilet paper in, but employees were wearing gloves. In Fremont County, we're lucky to be close to Sinks Canyon and the Wind River Mountains, so I've been seeing lots of people on social media taking advantage of that, going out hiking and biking and walking their dogs. Overall, though, I think people are rattled. There was a sense that being such a remote community, we might be insulated from all of this. But now that there's clear community spread in Lander, people are scared.
And your usual beat is covering the Wind River Reservation. How are folks there holding up?
Right. Well, there are no confirmed cases yet on the res, but there are lots of reasons why Wind River is especially vulnerable. There are a lot of health disparities there, high rates of illnesses like asthma, diabetes, heart disease. There's a high rate of people, especially older people, taking medication that suppresses their immune system. There's also a housing crisis on Wind River. Most people live in multi-generational homes. Many live in severely overcrowded homes where the disease could spread very quickly amongst 15 or 20 people. And the vast majority of tribal members rely on the reservation's 2 federally funded Indian Health Service facilities for care. Most don't have outside health insurance, meaning they don't have the flexibility to go elsewhere if the IHS clinics become overwhelmed. I will say, though, just from my observation, that it seems like those IHS clinics have been preparing farther in advance and perhaps more rigorously than others. I know Wind River Family and Community Healthcare had laid out protocol a month before Wyoming saw its first case. They also started triaging patients in their parking lot over a week ago, long before other facilities started taking that precaution. I spoke with Richard Brannon, CEO of Wind River Family and Community Healthcare. He said they've been preparing so rigorously because they don't expect any assistance from the feds.
You know, there isn't going to be a Lone Ranger coming riding up with a, you know, white hat and a white stallion and say, well, I'm going to save you or whatever. We have to be prepared, given the limitations of our resources.
Brannon called on the Indian Health Service to provide more tests to tribal clinics. He called on them to release emergency funding. Since then, the federal government has allocated over $100 million just for tribes and IHS facilities to fight COVID-19. We'll have to wait and see how much of that trickles down to Wind River.
Savannah Marr reporting from Lander. Thank you for the update.
Thank you.
We will return to COVID-19 later in the program. When we come back, we'll continue with the Mountain West News Bureau's Private Prison series. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Private prisons are often touted as a good source of jobs and economic prosperity for communities. But how do those jobs compare to the ones in government-run facilities? Part of our series, Private Prisons, Locking in the Facts, and with the support of the Pulitzer Center, the Mountain West News Bureau's Noah Glick took a look and found that there's no clear answer.
Let's get this out of the way. Finding employees in private prisons to talk about their job wasn't exactly easy, so I had to expand my search a bit.
There's very clearly a transparency issue in private prisons.
That's Ashley Dixon. She worked as a correctional officer for 7 months in 2017 at the Trousdale Turner Correctional Facility. That's a private prison about an hour outside of Nashville, Tennessee.
it was one of the hardest experiences of my life, the most difficult periods of my life, and I still feel like I'm recovering from it in a lot of ways.
Since she left, she's been outspoken against the facility and the company running it, CoreCivic. That's actually how I found her. She was testifying at a meeting of the Tennessee General Assembly.
It is an unhealthy and unsafe environment for everyone, both.
One of the big issues, she says, was chronic understaffing. Fewer people meant longer shifts that regularly went up to 16 or 20 hours. And she says that led to people falling asleep on their drive home or when making hospital runs for sick inmates.
There was also a problem with people falling asleep on their shift in the prison, at the hospital, with their gun at their side.
CoreCivic is one of two major private prison operators in the country with multiple facilities across the Mountain West.
We believe in advancing everyone.
CoreCivic declined an interview, but in a statement, a spokesperson said an internal investigation did confirm staff shortages at the Tennessee facility. The company says since then, it's raised its starting wages to the highest level in the state. Federal data seems to support a problem with staff levels in private facilities. The Bureau of Justice Statistics found that public prisons had 5 inmates per officer, compared to 7 inmates per officer at private prisons. But those stats are from 2005 and haven't been updated since. Current pay differences, however, are a little easier to track. On average, officers in public facilities make nearly $6,000 more a year. Still,
prisons, in terms of their pay and their benefits, are not all that bad compared to the outside world.
That's Dr. Karen Gedney. She worked as a public prison physician for 30 years. She says while officers tend to make less in the private sector, prisons overall still offer people with just a high school diploma a job with good wages and benefits. Nationwide, they can make somewhere between $31,000 all the way up to $76,000, depending on location and experience. Gedney says there's also opportunity for growth.
You can slowly climb up the ranks. And I have seen individuals who were custody officers who ultimately became wardens.
Still, she acknowledges working in a public or a private prison can be challenging, especially when it comes to safety. Early in her career, she says an inmate held her hostage.
And then he assaulted and raped me out of frustration and anger of all the things he would never have in life.
While Gedney's assault happened in the medical center at a publicly run prison in Nevada, a 2016 report from the Office of the Inspector General showed the rate of assaults against prison staff was about 3 times higher in private prisons. But Lauren Brooke Eisen says overall, it's really hard to make comparisons. She's the director of the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law.
There's so much that happens behind the prison gates that we just don't know about.
Eisen says there are also too many variables to consider. Is it a men's or women's prison? What state or local laws are there? What security level are the inmates and how many are there? But she does say there is one big difference that can affect work conditions. Private prison employees are often not unionized.
Because it's cheaper to hire individuals who don't necessarily need pensions. It's actually easier to fire people who are not unionized.
Ultimately, Eisen says there is one common thread in both public and private prisons. Both are driving mass incarceration across the country.
Those are both special interest groups that do have a reason to ensure that prisons are full.
She believes the ultimate solution to this public versus private debate is to reduce prisons overall and invest more in rehabilitation programs. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Noah Glick.
Continuing on with our private prison industry series, we're looking at how these large corporations are moving into a new sector, rehab and reentry services. Things like mental health counseling, drug treatment, electronic monitoring, and halfway houses. With the support of the Pulitzer Center, our Mountain West News Bureau's Ali Budner reports, this shift is at the crux of a recent conflict in Colorado.
Candy Sidabaca was elected to Denver's city council just last year.
A self-described democratic socialist who's already taking unprecedented action.
Sidabaca says one issue caught her attention right away. It was the fact that 2 private companies were running most of the city's community corrections facilities, also known as halfway houses, and it hit her personally.
My brother is actually in prison and has been through the community correction system. I live across the street from a halfway house that's been there my entire life. My district is the most saturated district with halfway houses. years.
The two companies were industry giants Geo Group and Core Civic, and Sita Baca was skeptical about their motives for helping people like her brother.
If they're in private prisons, you're making money. You're making profit while they're in community corrections. You're making profit while they're on your ankle monitors. You're making profit while they're taking your drug tests.
So she got public comments on the issue. Then she brought it to a vote at City Council, which decided to cut ties with both companies.
The decision to jump out of a plane without a parachute, I think, is what I've had the most concern with.
That's Greg Morrow. He oversees halfway house contracts for the city and county of Denver. So it fell into his lap to deal with the aftermath. He says the decision affected about 500 residents.
That was the biggest shock, is what do we do with the people that are in placement and their families and the uncertainty around that.
While the city scrambled for a plan, it temporarily extended the contracts. Geo's is now finished. Core Civic's will last at least another year. Morrow says what people don't realize is that Denver's halfway houses have been privately run since the 1970s, but by smaller companies. It wasn't until a few years ago that Geo and Core Civic took over the majority of the contracts. There was a reason for that.
What you'll see is maybe an entity that's more nimble and flexible and can adjust faster and is arguably and I think proven to be cheaper. With the public sector, things will get more expensive.
But he says the switch to Geo and Core Civic did raise questions about performance and incentives, even in his department.
No one, including myself, is not saying that there's a tremendous opportunity to improve outcomes.
Mostly, he says he was concerned about high staff turnover with the big companies. And he says the debate over public versus private is a legitimate one.
You deal with pros and cons either way.
With Core Civic's contract temporarily extended through June of 2021, I decided to go see one of its halfway houses for myself.
So this is our Fox facility.
Shannon Karst is managing director for all of the company's halfway houses in Colorado. She shows me around the Fox Reentry Center. It's a two-story concrete building in an industrial neighborhood near a major highway overpass in the heart of the city.
So we'll be walking down the hallway here and seeing some of the group rooms and the therapist rooms, and they'll be in group right now. So.
It houses about 90 male residents.
Good. That's a new resident. So he's happy to be here.
Karst has been working for the private sector in Denver's halfway houses for more than two decades. I ask her how she responds to criticism from people like Councilwoman Candy Sita Baca.
I think it's insulting to the staff here that have dedicated their lives to this.
So I ask her what she wants people to know. She tells me about holiday cards and notes from former residents thanking them for their services. But like her answers to most policy questions, ultimately she says this.
Yeah, I'd have to refer you back to public affairs.
And that public affairs response was that the company has, quote, made significant commitments to address the recidivism crisis in America. Either way, Denver is committed to ending its relationship with Core Civic. Who will fill the gap and how much that will cost remains to be seen. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Allie Budner.
Support for this series came from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, a nonprofit news organization that partners with journalists and newsrooms to support in-depth reporting and education around the globe. When we come back, more on COVID-19 in Wyoming. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. As people follow recommendations to stay home in the face of the coronavirus pandemic, some folks are left totally alone. That can be disruptive to mental health, especially in a state with one of the leading suicide rates. Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Jones reports.
How are you?
Oh, not too bad. Just listen to a little Beyonce at home.
That's Laramie local Jason Stenner Clark.
When I first got the adolescent blues, I think that a lot of people get in middle school.
As he got older, his depression got worse. And by the time he was about 30, Stenner Clark was diagnosed with severe bipolar disorder with psychotic features.
I contemplated suicide a great deal in 2011 and then attempted, I suppose, about 5 years later.
But he hasn't considered suicide since. That's in large part because of things like medication, counseling, getting plenty of sleep, and his routines.
Having coffee in the morning in downtown Laramie. I know a lot of retirees, veterans who aren't, you know, at the workplace at, say, 8, 9, 10 a.m. And then after that, I eat at the Laramie Soup Kitchen, which is a wonderful place open to the whole community.
Stenner Clark also likes to stop by the shops and hear gossip from local business owners.
Well, you know, the new business that opened or shut down, someone retired, someone moved, someone passed away, someone got married, someone had babies.
And he reads a lot.
I guess I left that out, the public library one. That's like my secret.
He goes there at least once a week. Or he did, until it closed to the public. Coffee shops and other local businesses have closed too. The Laramie Soup Kitchen has transitioned to to-go meals. And while those measures keep people physically safe from the coronavirus, social isolation and disruption to routine could have big impacts on mental health.
Isolation is a funny thing because as human beings, we crave to be social and emotionally connected to other human beings.
That's therapist Nikki Rossiter.
So it is quite the opposite of what we have always thought in an educated world to be what's healthy for us.
And Rossiter says she's seeing heightened anxiety and depression among her patients. According to the Centers for Disease Control, Wyoming has the second highest rate of suicide in the United States. And this region, the Mountain West, has the highest rate of suicide. Lindsay Martin is the Injury and Violence Prevention Program Manager at the Wyoming Department of Health. She says most of her job is devoted to suicide prevention. And Martin is concerned about two groups in particular.
Middle-aged men, and the other population with the highest rate are our senior citizens.
But Martin says there are simple things we can do to take care of the most vulnerable among us.
Being better neighbors, taking care of the people in your community, reaching out to them, especially right now, supporting seniors. Most every community in Wyoming has a senior center, so calling them, seeing what they need, just trying to bring those people who are more isolated in our communities and make them feel seen and heard and a part of the community.
And Nikki Rossiter, the therapist, says if you know someone who struggles with depression or anxiety, now is the time to call them for a friendly chat. And even if you aren't alone, these are uncertain times. Rossiter suggests new structures, like a walk or yoga every morning at 10 a.m., making tea, journaling. And once this story is over,
I would say avoid excessive exposure to media coverage. I would say connect more through the internet. You know, there's things like you could watch Netflix at the same time as your friends. If somebody pauses it to go to the bathroom, everyone's paused and you can have like a side chat.
And basic needs like sleep, regular healthy meals, limiting caffeine, breaks for mindfulness or meditation. Things we might not ordinarily have time for. And if you want some counseling, there's telemental health. That's where you talk to a therapist through a secure video chat software.
Surf the internet, find out who you want to see, read their profiles.
Meanwhile, Jason Stenner Clark says all this coronavirus stuff is reminding him of the poet John Donne. You know, no man is an island.
I think the thing that heartens me most is we're all in this at the same time together just so quickly that even though that we're separate from one another, we are still separate together.
At the end of our phone call, instead of goodbye, he says, breathe easy. Hope you do the same. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Erin Jones.
Scientists are working hard to understand what we can do about COVID-19. As Ray Ellen Bichelle reports, that includes a few groups in the Mountain West.
Sometime around Valentine's Day, a box arrived at a lab on the western edge of Fort Collins, Colorado. It contained vials full of coronavirus. just what Lindsay Hartson and her colleagues had been waiting for.
But yes, we were really excited.
They got started growing the virus first. Then, once there was enough of it to work with, Hartson got to business experimenting with different ways of killing it.
Killer of many viruses.
Hartson is a lab manager at Colorado State University's Infectious Disease Research Center, and she's doing this work because a killed virus is the key ingredient in the COVID-19 vaccine they're trying to make.
Right. Okay, so
the idea is that the killed virus would act like a wanted poster for the immune system, basically saying the virus looks like this size, this shape, and it's dangerous. But in order to make a good wanted poster, you have to kill the virus the right way. You can't completely obliterate it. It still needs to look like the virus that causes COVID-19.
If we don't have it exactly, we're very close.
Hartson's weapons of choice sound ridiculously simple. Vitamins and light. To be specific, she puts the virus in a plastic bag, squirts in some vitamin B2, also known as riboflavin.
If you take a vitamin supplement or a daily supplement, you're likely taking some riboflavin into your diet.
And then she slides the bag into what looks like a copy machine to give it a dose of UV light equivalent to about 1/4 of a second in a tanning bed.
The actual light treatment itself takes less than a minute, which is fantastic. It's pretty quick.
The combination of vitamin B2 plus UV light ruins the virus's genetic material, so it can't multiply.
Really, the next big step is, does this induce an immune response? You know, we're very confident in our ability to inactivate the virus and produce that end of the vaccine. Now the question is, will it do what we want it to do in an in vivo model?
In this case, the term in vivo model is a fancy way of saying hamsters. Hartson's waiting on her colleagues in another lab to figure out if the virus she killed actually gets hamsters' immune systems going. The next step after that, expose the hamsters to the live virus and see if the vaccine protects them. Ray Goodrich is the executive director of the Infectious Disease Research Center at Colorado State University. He says they expect to know by the end of April if it's working or not.
The step in parallel that we'll be running is, how do we scale this up?
It's important to point out this is just one option for a potential vaccine. For example, researchers over in Seattle came up with a potential vaccine using a different approach and have already started testing to see if it's safe in people. Goodrich says that's fine.
When you have a problem of this magnitude, attacking it from every possible angle that you can is wise.
Meanwhile, in a small town called Hamilton, Montana, scientists with the National Institutes of Health are also working hard on COVID-19.
My name is Emmy DeWitt.
I'm Vincent Munster.
They work at a place called Rocky Mountain Laboratories, and they aren't offering any interviews at the moment because they're slammed with COVID work. So I dug up some recordings I made back when I visited the place in 2016,
Nipah virus,
when they'd been studying all kinds of nasty viruses.
Ebola virus. Then there's MERS coronavirus.
And now, the virus that causes COVID-19. On that visit 4 years ago, they showed me what it was like to do this work.
Undo it from down there.
For really serious stuff like Ebola, they take these special suits off a rack. They look like floppy plastic spacesuits with rubber boots attached. They attach an air hose so they don't breathe in anything bad.
Because, of course, as soon as you close that zipper, you're going to be in a plastic bubble with no air otherwise.
And zip themselves inside. I gave it a try.
So this is what it feels like inside. It feels like an airplane, a tiny airplane.
DeWitt says you get used to it.
I really like to be that focused on just one thing, and you just can't be distracted by other stuff. You're in your own little bubble doing your own thing.
And right now, they're in that bubble big time. While they don't need to be in this extreme gear for COVID-19, because it isn't Ebola, this is the lab and protection that they have, and they've been busy. They already figured out how the virus invades human cells, and they just came out with a study that found that the new coronavirus can stick around on plastic and steel for up to 2 or 3 days. Now, on their infinite to-do list, test the efficacy of future vaccines. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle.
Thank you.
With COVID-19 showing up in Wyoming, we thought we would speak to a couple of University of Wyoming students from China who were in their country around the time that outbreak occurred. Wyoming Public Radio's Nina Rao says they already experienced many things people in the United States are going through right now.
Ling Li was on vacation with her family in China when the country confirmed its initial cases of coronavirus.
After the traveling, when we got back to home, we found the Wuhan city was under quarantine.
She started to see more people taking precautions, like wearing face masks frequently. The number of confirmed cases also increased.
So when I came back here, so I was very worried about I infected.
Here, as in Laramie, she's a graduate student at the University of Wyoming. Ling studies kinesiology, and she returned to school after winter break.
So when I back, I wear the mask.
Ling was concerned that she was infected and might infect others. And that's what she did for the first 2 weeks she arrived. Ling wore a mask everywhere. She even stopped teaching her classes.
I checked my body temperature twice every day just in case I have had fever or something uncomfortable for me. So I just want to double check. I'm not sick. I'm fine.
Ling, as recommended, took her body temperature for 14 days straight. I asked Ling if she felt like fear took over her.
If you fear that other people, maybe other people will fear you, right? Everybody has a chance to have this infection, right? So you can't like feel everybody because, yeah, maybe you are the virus, right?
A lot has happened since that conversation in February. Ling says it had a huge impact on her family.
My parents just stay at home, stop their business. So they just go outside for buying some stuff they needed. There are no any money from the business. That's a problem.
This narrative is similar with other Chinese international students and their families.
During the Chinese New Year.
That's Qinglan Lang. She's an undergraduate student here at the university, and she's from the province of Guangdong, China.
My parents didn't meet my grandpa and grandma during that special period.
If you're not aware, Chinese New Year is a huge deal in China and other places that celebrate it. It runs from January through February. It was also around the time that the coronavirus started growing in that country.
My parents are very sad about the condition. They can't go out, they can't meet relatives, and during the period that they should be together, eat hot pot, do some happy activities.
And that trickled all the way to the University of Wyoming campus. Here's Yikai Peng. She's the president of the Chinese Students and Scholars Association at the university.
After this outbreak in coronavirus, I asked the group of people, the Chinese group, said if they would still want to go to the celebration or not.
The Chinese New Year celebration.
And more people voted on canceling it than the other. So that's why I decide it's probably a better idea since more people are concerning about it. So I cancel it.
The reason they canceled it was because they had all recently returned from China and was concerned about possibly spreading COVID-19. But that decision wasn't easy.
I mean, I am sad. This is a tradition that we always do in the University of Wyoming. We've been doing it for years. But I think it's for the best. I think it's a good decision.
They're hopeful, though. The number of COVID-19 cases is currently lower than before in China. And Qinglan believes that if the world has survived Ebola, Zika virus, and bird flu, then it can survive this too.
And I know that scientists all over the world is trying to find vaccine or some medicine of this virus. So I think we just need time to solve it.
Now that it's showing up in Wyoming, Yikai has some advice.
I understand that people are panicking, but it would be great if everybody is just reading from like trustworthy newspaper to get their information instead of listening to some of the rumors.
That's advice that many health workers are giving for people in the United States. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Nina Rao.
Coming up on the program, it's Sunshine Week, and we will speak with the woman who's helping all of us get our documents in the state. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Over the years, there's been a conflict between news, advocacy organizations, and members of the public versus government agencies when it comes to documents and information. Many times, these issues go to court. In an effort to make all sides play together better, the legislature created the position of ombudsman to settle these disputes. Ruth Van Mark is that person and joins us to discuss her role in the state.
To respond to complaints filed by people who have attempted to get public records from a governmental entity. And that entity can be either at the state level, their city, their county, or maybe a special use district. I like to pick on the Veteran Fire Department. Mm-hmm. If you were trying to get records out of the Veteran Fire Department and they weren't responding to you, you could call the Public Records Ombudsman, and that person would attempt to see if they could see what the problem is and work out an agreement where you could get the records you need.
This is part of a transparency push, and of course, as you've probably learned since taking over the job, there have been challenges occasionally of getting records. Have you had much success with this as of yet?
We all thought I was just going to be snowed in, a blizzard, or whatever you want to say in Wyoming of requests. But it hasn't been a lot. So I'm taking that, interpreting that to be a good sign that our folks at the county, state, and local level are really interested in getting the records that you're asking for. Sometimes it's just a matter of confusion. So because I haven't been getting a lot of responses, complaints filed with me, I don't know how interesting this interview is going to be.
Well, we'll see about that. How do you see your role? Are you going to be like a referee? Are you going to be somebody mean? Or are you going to be a mediator? How do you see yourself?
I'm a mediator. That's the role that the legislature laid out for me. They gave me essentially three defined responsibilities, and the most important being the mediator between the requester and the governmental entity. And then, of course, the other one is I get to waive fees. I have yet to waive a fee. I've yet to have anyone ask me to waive a fee. I've had people ask me to waive privilege, which I told them that's outside of my bailiwick. They've asked me to waive a subpoena. I told them, no, you have to go to court to get that done. So there's maybe a little bit of confusion of how much power the ombudsman has. But if you read the legislation authorizing this position, the legislature was very clear, I believe. They want the ombudsman to be the person you go to when you want to work out an agreement with the person that you're trying or the agency you're trying to get the information from.
Frequently, Ruth, we'll have situations where we want to know how much an entity has spent on something, how many years this has been going on. We a lot of times also are curious about communication. Some of that is under Wyoming law, and I understand that. But let's start with the first one. How hard is it? One of the challenges we've had is, sure, we can go back and dig up that information for you, but it'll cost you $10,000. I'm making a number up, but that's been the problem. Have you been able to resolve those issues?
You know, I haven't had an issue about costs as of yet, but we do know that the legislature tasked the A&I to come up with a fee schedule, which they did. And under that fee schedule, the first $180 of cost is free to the individual requesting it. And then afterwards, after that $180, there are fees attached based on the type of information you're getting and how they have to if they're reproducing it for you.
My anticipation is I would call you up and say the number they've provided me isn't fair. This is out of line. So how would you resolve something like that?
Well, hypothetically, I would say the first thing I'd go to is talk to the agency or the entity that you're asking the information from and hear from them. You know, it's always possible that the sheer volume of what you're asking for is what's driving up the cost. If we can work out something where you narrow your focus and the request you're making so that it's a manageable amount of documents, then that will address the cost issue. But as I've said, I haven't had a question about cost just yet, so I'm just speculating at this point how I would handle something like that.
The other one is email communication. That's always a little bit of a tricky one. What's your stance going to be as far as a news organization who's investigating, I think, probably a legitimate story, wanting to know maybe an influence by an outside person on a particular vote or something like that? What can you and cannot do in a situation like that?
Well, first off, I have been advised very sternly that I shouldn't telegraph in advance how I would respond to a question like that. So I'm not going to respond to the question like that, except to say this, that I think it's critical that both the requester and the governmental entity feel like they have an opportunity of somebody who's going to listen to both sides of the story and work with both of them in an impartial way to come up with something that they can both live with. Again, I have to say this, that every agency I've had the opportunity to visit with so far, they want to release the information. It's just sometimes a question of confusion about what the person is asking for and what the best way is to try to address coming to an agreement.
And that they see, oh my gosh, this is good, to get every email on this topic is going to take weeks and months, which is probably not necessarily what we're after. Is there a way we can craft some of the requests to make it a little easier for everybody involved?
Having a good dialogue, be it through the ombudsman or with the agency directly. I've had several conversations with state-level agencies that get lots of requests, and that's the first thing they say to me, is that initially their conversation with the requester is, they're asking for the sun, moon, and stars. And in reality, all they really wanted was the stars. And so the longer they visit with them, the more they're able to narrow down the request. And then certainly in an email situation, that helps a lot because, well, it's easy to gather the emails that you've requested. Sometimes those are emails that need to be gone through one by one to make sure there's no confidential information in it. So that's what many times takes the time. So if you can narrow the request down so it's a manageable amount of documents to go through, that makes it much easier for the agency and much less expensive for the requester.
Just with you being here, do you think it's helped because people know you're here and probably will get involved if there is any trouble?
You know, I haven't had any direct experience with that, but some of my colleagues have said when I've called an agency, they'll say, so-and-so from such-and-such place told me that they got a call from you today, and they were, like, really nervous. And I said, I'm not that intimidating, I hope. But I do think that people respect what the legislature was trying to achieve. And they know that if you get a call from the ombudsman, that means that you need to start working with the individual if you hadn't before.
If they say to you, I'm not going to release those records, we don't want to do it.
Well, the law gives the ombudsman the ability to basically look at information that the agency says they're not going to release and determine whether or not good cause exists for them not to release that, even if it's considered confidential. Now, the ombudsman has to keep that information confidential, but they can look at it and say, you know what, I agree with you, this is confidential under the law, and therefore you don't have to release it, or I disagree with you, and I think it should be released. Now, the kicker here is that nothing I say or do is legally binding. The agency can always say, we don't agree with you, we're going to go to court. Mm-hmm. They can always say that. Or they can say, well, okay, we'll work with you to see if we can come to a compromise.
And is that essentially the appeals process? Is an agency like myself, we would have to go to court?
I believe as you look at the law now, that is the next step for you, because you can't really appeal the ombudsman's decision because it's not legally binding. But the ombudsman was put in place so that you could avoid going to court and come up with a settlement or an agreement that you're comfortable with and the agency is comfortable with and save everybody a lot of time and money.
Obviously, I've been talking from a journalist perspective, but if you're a nonprofit group or interested citizen group or something, you're available to them as well.
Absolutely. I'm available to anybody who wants to call and talk to me. Now, under the current law, my services are limited to the people requesting the information, but in this session, the legislature passed some revisions to the Ombudsman Act, which allows me to help both the governmental entity and the requester. So anybody who wants to talk to me, I'm happy to talk to him.
Ruth Van Mark, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, too.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. This and all of our shows can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces. You can listen to individual interviews and features from this site, as well as other programs as well. And you'll never miss an episode if you get our Open Spaces podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. By the way, we're sharing all of our COVID-19 stories on our website and via all of our social media pages, so be sure to follow our Facebook and Twitter handles. You can find me on Twitter under the name of Butter Bob. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.